Hello again, everybody, and welcome back. We are here with yet another episode of Pod Nuts Pro. This is episode 94. We have been chugging right along. And so I am Marvin B., and I am joined tonight by our good friend, Matt Rainey. How are you tonight, sir?
I am on the tail end of another itis.
Oh, the itises. How are they doing?
They're not doing well.
You gotta kick those people out of your house.
I have tried. It's the second itis I've had in 3 weeks, and it's getting pretty old.
Yeah, I don't like the itises. I like the Benjamins, but I don't like the Murphys either.
I haven't missed work for sickness in a long, long time. I missed half a day on Monday, a few days ago.
Oh. So do your sick days or paid time off or however you do it, do they accumulate? Do you have a stack of unused PTO that you had to cut into for that?
No. Luckily, as a partner, I don't have to worry about keeping track of sick days, vacation days, personal days, any of that.
Good. I don't either, although I technically have an employee, so I should, but my employee is my wife, so it's kind of hard to tell her, honey, you've used too many days this year. You can't.
I'm going to need you to go in today, and I'm off. I'm going to need you to go in
That's
today.
Right. Just go answer the phones, tell them I'm not available, but.
Just take the messages. I'll see you after work.
Yeah. All right, and so those of you paying attention probably realize that we are only two-thirds of the M&M show, and our good friend Martin Obando had some work come up and wasn't able to join tonight, but he will be back, and we won't have a camera following him around as we had planned, but one day we might. So let's get right into the show. So Matt, what's been going on the past week?
Well, some interesting stuff. I got two quick things, tips. Now, the first tip, I think, and I want to see if you've heard of this, because I just found out about this, and it's a good tip. Maybe I'm late to the party, and you all say, God, you didn't know that? What's wrong with you? But when you have a computer joined to a domain, you log in with, of course, domain name / username. Sometimes you want to log into the local computer, right? Computer name / username. If you're trying to walk a user through finding the local computer name to log in as a local account, what do you do?
What do I do?
Yep.
Well, I have a piece of software that I use that I can kind of cheat. And
No. They're not in any kind of dashboard. It's just Joe Schmo. He's on a domain. You need to tell him how to find his local computer name.
Well, usually what I'll do is have them log out. And, well, they're probably already logged out if they can't get in. But usually I just have them start typing administrator in the user box, and the domain name underneath their password should change to the local computer name.
Does that in Windows 7?
Windows 7. What? Why? What?
Okay, so here's what I found.
Windows 10?
I don't know if I've ever seen a change like that. You can click on, this is not my tip, but before I was doing the link that says, how do I log into another domain? Right below the login screen.
Okay.
Click on that, and in there it tells you the local computer name. But let's say it's an annoying computer name, like ABC847385-27NB.
Oh, you mean it's a Dell?
I don't want to. Then tell the user, okay, write that down. Then we're going to put in that / administrator. The tip is you don't even have to know local computer name. You can type in at the username ./ administrator, and the dot is, it'll just take it to mean this local computer. Did you know that?
I did not, but I'm sure.
I just found this
I'm
out.
I'm sure we're going to get a stack of email that will say, yeah, we knew that.
So for those who didn't know it, ./ administrator instead of local computer name / administrator will get you logging into the local computer. I thought that was kind of neat. And I didn't believe it, so I went and tried it. And I'm sure now that if those of you who have not heard it are also trying it right now, too, if you're by a computer.
Right.
But it's true. Dot, just dot. Instead of computer name, just a dot. That's tip number one. And I'm glad you didn't hear about it, because you could have said, well, I just have them use ./administrator. And then we need the cricket sound, but good. All right. Now, we've all seen the pop-ups, right, on the browser that says, hey, don't shut your computer down. If you shut your computer down, you will lose all your files, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, yeah. It's just a browser redirect, you know, like an advertisement that popped this up, and you can't close
it. Call this number right away.
Right. So I had a client that has a Mac that had this, and I told him, well, it's easy to just force quit Safari and reopen it, and you should be back at your homepage. No, doesn't work. That's not how Safari works on the Mac. Did you know that?
I probably have only touched one Mac in my lifetime, so no, I did not know that.
So in Safari, maybe it's just a combination of her version of the OS, which I don't remember which one it was. I think it was a new one, Sierra. And her Safari. If you go to Safari Preferences, you can tell it what to do when you open a new window or a new tab. You know, go to your homepage, go to a blank page, you know, those standard options, right? But there is, you can set a homepage, but the default option, and you cannot change this in the GUI, is when Safari opens, it always opens to the last page or pages you were on, always. So for them, the last page that we're on was this pop-up. They couldn't go anywhere else. If Safari opened, it would go to that page. Now, to fix it, and I'll put it in the show note, you've got to run a terminal command to disable Safari Apple persistence. Basically, I'll say it here, but we'll put in the show notes. Defaults space write.com.apple.safari space Apple persistence ignore state space yes. Basically saying ignore the state it was on when you closed. When you open, just open to a clean slate, whatever the homepage is. And that fixed it for them. It's just Safari having no option in the GUI to, when you open Safari, to go to your homepage.
So my thought is, how in the world did you find that? How long did it take you to figure that out?
Well, once I figured out what Safari was doing, it didn't take me long. I just did a search for something like how to have Safari open homepage or something like that. And I Googled it and I found it in a few articles. But yeah, that's pretty annoying. I would think that would come up a lot, but I've been using Macs for 10 years and I've never noticed that.
So here's a question. It sounds like this person is not under, first of all, can you put Macs in the LogicNow dashboard?
Yes.
So the thing that I've been doing with Internet Explorer and Firefox and all that is I'll just go into, you know, LogicNow, and you can go into the remote, what is it, the remote background of the computer and then close that out. I mean, could you not have done that with the Mac?
I could close Safari. Yeah, they can close
it, but when they reopen it. So
that terminal command is set to remember its persistence, basically. So, hey, I was on this page last, so that must be what you want to go back to when you reopen Safari, is what they're thinking.
Right. Wow.
Which is funny because this could lead to a lot of trouble, right? Let's say you're browsing something that you don't want someone to see, and you just close Safari.
Oh, you mean like...
And somebody comes behind
if you were doing a Jared?
And see, I've never noticed. I've never had a problem to even look for this, but you could go behind somebody else and just open Safari and see whatever they were on last. I guess the tip here is use this terminal command to disable that, or before you close Safari, hit your home button and go home.
That is interesting, you know, because I have noticed, you know, Internet Explorer has started doing that where it will, you know, when you open up a tab or something and it has all of those thumbnails of the last pages you visited.
Right.
And you're right, because even those images can be a site that you visited that you don't want somebody to know that you were there. And if you're not paying attention, you know, just having that pop up, and if somebody's watching you, I don't know if I like that.
I don't like it, and I'm not going anywhere where anyone can. I really care if anybody sees, but I just don't like it because it's just a weird option. Why would you always want to go back to the last place. That should be at least it should be an option in the GUI.
Right. And not that it would all be always be bad things, folks. I mean, let's say I'm shopping for the wife, you know, and I find a nice little piece of jewelry, and I just don't want her to open a browser and see the last page I visited was, you know, Jared.com, you know, or whatever that website is. You know, he went to Jared.
Or you could just do that on purpose, and she'll think that you're getting her something.
Rainey, how long have you been married?
Almost 25 years. This year will be 25 years.
You know that you don't get the wife thinking something and then not do it.
I didn't make her think it. She just, if she's going behind me and she just looks at that, you know, I don't know what she's doing. I don't know if she's going to see it.
Yeah, but you know that the clock will start ticking every day. She's going to be like, is this the day? Is this the day? And then at some point, you know that turns. It's like that law of diminishing returns, you know, that first lick of the ice cream is, oh, so wonderful. And, you know, then you get the brain freeze and the next lick isn't as good. And, you know, by day four or five, if you haven't shown up with that box.
But see, then by that time, I can go leave a different page open, like a Google search for, like, wool shirts for women.
Okay, that. All right, so you've actually are at the point past that line in your marriage where your wife's not going to maim you.
No. And then I might just buy her a wool shirt for women, and it would be a surprise. And then she might think, well, where's my Jared ring?
Yeah, that's right.
I went a different direction.
Yeah, that was, I'm not even going to go there. We went down.
It's kind of like when you go to your friend's computer. And you go to Google and you search for, like, you know, men's grown-up diapers. And that way they get all the pop-ups and ads on their page for weird
Why
things.
Why would you use the phrase, it's like when you? Like you've done this.
I may have done that before.
Because I can't remember the last time I've even thought to search for adult men's diapers, let alone think to go to somebody's computer and type it in.
Okay, so if you want to mess with somebody, just go type a bunch of stuff and search for a bunch of weird stuff, and they're going to wonder why their ads are all showing some strange things. And I've searched for some strange things on people's computers to get them some good ads.
So I have done the remote import of, let's just say, questionable internet favorites, so that when somebody goes onto a computer and you're instructing them, well, just go to your favorites and click the link. they open up all of these links to very inappropriate, non-work-related sites. So, that's about as mischievous as I get. So, all right. So, you know, I had a relatively quiet week, thank goodness. But I did have an interesting thing where I just thought I wanted to bring up. I've been working with a few techs now where I subcontract them for times when I need extra technicians. And of course, if they need technicians, they can sub me out. And I had a gentleman that I've worked with now, and we're talking, my business has officially been in existence for 19 years this year. And I've worked with this guy for 18 of those years. And for the most part, I would put him as my equal in terms of colleagues. He has, you know, done a lot of things in the network field, working with businesses mostly. So I felt that we were on the same level. So he's kind of hit a rough patch where he's lost a couple of his big clients. And so as he's, you know, revamping and redoing stuff, I've had some nice jobs where I could at least use him to help supplement his income, and hopefully he'll get back on his feet 100%. But I felt bad because I sent him out to a job where all he was supposed to do was set up a brand new computer. And I set up most of my computers so that once it gets on the network and an internet connection, I've got my remote support software that I can automatically connect and finish everything. So he doesn't really have to do much. He just goes there, set it up, gets it on the internet, and then he can leave. And then I log in and do the rest. Well, the place where he was setting this up, the cable wasn't getting a connection. And from my perspective, I was just thinking, well, maybe the patch panel had to be made live. So I had sent with him three cables, you know, one for the desktop and, you know, an extra long one in case, you know, the jack was across the room or something like that. And I sent him a, you know, a 3-foot patch cable for the server room. Well, he could not find where the jack was located. He could not find a live connection. And after a little bit of work, we just basically punted, told the customer that they had called their cable guy out, made sure it was a live jack. So he and I were talking afterwards, and we have had a few jobs where he's not known exactly, you know, how I do things. Things like, what do I do if I'm needing to duplicate a hard drive on site? Or if I need to transfer files and settings for a customer. And he basically came to me and said, so as I'm going out on these jobs for you, what do you think that I should be carrying with me in my toolkit? So I really had to stop myself because, like I said, I've worked with this guy for a long time. And I just, for some reason, I just assumed he would know the things that he should be carrying with him on a regular basis. And it was just odd to me that he had been working in the industry this long. Now, granted, he's more of a network guy. He doesn't really like working on desktops. He really, you know, he wants to be that server guy. He wanted to be doing cloud stuff. And so a lot of the day-to-day stuff that most network support people would do, he just hasn't done. So things like carrying, you know, network cable testers and toners just didn't really occur to him. Carrying the software tools that we talk about all the time, you know, Fabs Auto Backup, D7, even some of the malware removal tools. So I just basically have now decided I'm going to make a list for him of stuff to carry around. So I just, you know, I know that you technically don't have to deal with that exact scenario, but I thought I would ask you, when you have new techs come and work for you, do you have a standard list that you give them or that you're asking them in the interview process? You know, what tools have you used? What software do you know? That sort of thing. Because if I was just hiring this guy without knowing who he was and, you know, he told me that he carried no tools with him, I'd be like, well, then you need to not be in the rest of this interview.
Right. There's in the interview, I think you have to, whatever your most activities are, if you do this thing a lot and this thing a lot, throw that at them and see how they would handle the situation. They should at least know the procedures of basic troubleshooting. If you don't have a live connection, what do you do and see how they would handle that. When we hire people, we usually have them shadow somebody for a week or two, and I can ask the tech that he's shadowing, hey, how has he been? Where do you think his strengths and weaknesses are? And then maybe for the second week, he's letting the new tech take the lead on the jobs, and he's there to make sure he doesn't screw it up. But we give them standard tools. We have the duplicators, and it's really hard to know. It's when a job comes in, I think it's important to call the customer because the customer's description is rarely descriptive enough to tell. I don't like to go in blind to any job. I'd rather call them and say, hey, tell me what's going on. Talk to them a little bit, and then I can gauge what I think is going on and what tools we'll need to bring.
Yeah, but in a situation like that where you're doing a new station setup, I mean, granted, if we're not on the road all the time as a tech, we're not going to know to carry a big tackle box worth of, you know, network patch cables and, you know, spare cards. I mean, I guess in my mind, I'm thinking that, you know, I've always had stuff in the back of my Jeep that I carry with me all the time. I've got my testers, obviously, but I've got my spare cables. I've got my toner. I've got a spare video card, a spare hard drive, a spare, you know, back in the days, how many times, you know, spare modems, sound cards, stuff like that. Even a keyboard and mouse, which I don't always have a keyboard because I'm always leaving spares at my customers and stuff, but.
Yeah, I used to carry a lot of that stuff around. I've gotten to the point where I don't carry as much stuff around now because I can usually tell from my conversation with them what's going on. Now, you're always going to run into something that's unexpected. Sometimes we don't carry our testers around because there's seven of us, and we've got one, now two testers, but we can't leave it in one person's car for them to tow it around. So that's always going to be at the office unless you're using it. But they do have patch cables, and my techs don't even carry around hard drives. If we need a hard drive, we'll come back to the office and grab a hard drive, grab a duplicator, go out there. We don't carry all that stuff around.
Well, maybe not everything. Yeah, I would. I mean, for me, I guess I'm used to it because it's only me I have to worry about in theory. But when I send out the subcontractors, yeah, I will do what you do, where what's the job and what do I send them with? And in my mind, I sent him with spare cables. I sent him with stuff, but it never occurred to me to send a tester with him.
Yeah, and I wouldn't have done that either. But see, that's another thing. So apparently these jacks aren't labeled.
No.
See, that would be nice.
No.
When you do cabling, when you're running cabling, you should always label this stuff. You shouldn't be able to look at the jack and it's going to be labeled, you know, A4, meaning switch A, port 4 is where it goes, or patch panel A, you know, port 4 in the patch panel, and then you can trace that to the switch. But those cables have to be labeled. And I've gone to places before where they weren't labeled and we had a hard time locating cables. And we talked to them and said, look, whoever did this cabling, it's not labeled. We would like to come in here and test everything, label everything. It's going to take some time, but later on, there's less troubleshooting, less downtime later on to try and locate these cables. And a lot of them have said, go ahead and do it. We'll find open pins here and there they didn't know about. Maybe their connection was slow and now it's faster. That's a good way to get in there and get some extra work. And it's going to be better for them.
And it makes life so much easier down the road when you are trying to troubleshoot stuff, which is, you know, that's one of the reasons I always carry my tester with me. And I always, you know, if I know that there's a cable job that's being done, I will always go back in after the cable company and verify what they told me, because even if they did label them, how many times have you run across a job where the numbers are wrong?
Yeah.
So, but that was just a thing I wanted to bring up. And yeah, there's cable guys especially.
And I wish I had a cable tester for every one of my guys, but like, sometimes you don't expect the cabling to be bad. It doesn't just go bad.
No, but I did think about the fact that, and I told him that he probably should invest in just a basic tester to carry with him. Even, you know, I don't want to say something as cheap as the, you know, the $50 testers that, you know, you can get. But if that's where you got to start, that's where you got to start. I recommended to him that he, you know, as soon as he gets in a position where he can, to purchase the Lynx printer, you know, just to have with him at all time. It's something that's small, he can carry in his bag, and it's not going to, you know, help in every cable situation, but it helps in probably 50 to 75% if you're just trying to tone out a quick cable or something, or see if it's live.
So did you find out what's wrong with the cable?
The cable company came out and fixed it and labeled it. I have no idea what they did, really. But it took about a week, and the customer finally called back and said, okay, we're ready, come back now.
See, what I would have done, and I don't know if it's possible, I would have told my tech to check this. Check and see if there's a different connection that's live that we can use. Just to get the computer set up.
Oh, he did. There was
okay.
Actually, the room had like four cable connections in there, and there was one even on the other side of the room that he, you know, I gave him a long enough cable that he could have, you know, hooked it up on the other side of the room if he had to.
Yeah.
In this case, he would have had to, you know, go down the hall to another office, and that was.
Well, that's a long patch cable.
Yeah, that was just. That's where we said, okay, we're not doing that.
But I would like to have got it set up. At least now you're not waiting on. Me, you're waiting on the cable company, and whenever it's fixed, just plug it in, you'll be up and running. Even if you brought it to another office, set it up, disconnected it, brought it back where it needs to go, and say, here, look, plug this cable into the wall when they fix the cable. Right.
Well, this customer wasn't one that I would have offered that to them. So, anyway, but just as you were mentioning earlier about the cable deal, I actually today ran into a situation where I was going to find a door controller for a customer that has key fobs, and they lost the network connection to their door controller, and it was in a different office than the firm administrator was. And when I asked her, I said, well, I know that the building's had electrical issues, maybe it's off, did you call somebody to see if it came back on? She's like, no. Long story short is I went there today and basically opened up the door controller. It's basically just one of the, it's like an alarm box on the side of the wall. I open it up. I see the patch cable plugged in. There's no light. I pull the cable out to see if there's a connection. I have my tester with me, and I notice that it's labeled with a number of 221. And I'm thinking, okay, well, maybe that's patch panel 2, port 21. So I go over to the patch panel, not it. And I found three other cables that were labeled 220, 221, 222. can't find where they go at all. And I can tell how long they are. And basically, the bottom line is the most I would do is grab a chair, pop the ceiling tile to see if I could figure out which direction it was going. And once I saw it disappear into a mess of cable, I said, you know what? Call your cable guy.
Yeah.
So even if you do have the numbers, like, you know, we were saying earlier, I could not find them anywhere on the patch panel. Every cable except for like two or three had a light, had a connection. And the three that
do you have a tone generator that you could hook up to it? You have one of those?
I actually, my toner is in storage.
I haven't had to use it in a while, but we used to have use that thing all the time to try and find cables.
Yeah, the one I have, it's the battery always dies on it, and I rarely use it, so I've stopped carrying it. And yes, a day like today would have been the time where having that would have been great. I had three network testers, and none of them really did me any good.
Yeah, that kind of thing. You need the tone generator. Now, I used to like to, we were trying to find cables in doctor's offices in the waiting room, and you press the button, and you get the radio on it. You ever had that happen?
Yeah.
It comes in perfectly clear.
Hey, you're listening to the sweet sounds.
But that tone generator worked. We used to use that a lot because nothing was ever labeled. You couldn't tell where anything went. That's amazing. You just get near, you get something. But
I got to order another one. I mean, and the great thing is the Fluke tools I have, they all have, you know, the receivers that you can actually put on the end of the cable, and they're all built in. So that's just me being lazy, I guess.
So I had a client call me. And actually, it was two people from the same office. They called within an hour of each other, neither one knowing that the other called. And the complaint was from the first one, I'm sorry, the report. They reported an issue that after they upgraded to Sage 2017, all the computers are running slow. I didn't get to call her back. This is just a ticket that popped up. About an hour later, somebody else calls. Same company, his computer's been running slow lately, locking up, running slow. So they're in our dashboard, and I look up the first one, and I notice she's only got 4 gigs of RAM. I said, well, that's probably the problem. We can just upgrade the RAM. But then on second look, I see Windows 7 32-bit as the operating system. I said, well, that's strange, 32-bit. And this is not the same client that I talked about last week that needed Windows 7 32-bit. Okay, this is a different client. So I didn't know any of the clients were running 32-bit OSs. I checked the other person. He's also running Windows 7 32-bit. Then I go look at all the other computers, like 20-something computers at the company, and they're all running Windows 7 32-bit.
Every single one.
Every one. So the second person is one of the owners. So I called him, and I'm telling him, you're running Windows 7 32-bit. My guess is you're just hitting the limitation, and it's a 4 gig limit. And if you look in, you know, computer properties, you're probably seeing like 2.75 usable. I said, is there a reason that you're running 32-bit? And he said, yes, there's a specific software that we're running. We can only run on 32-bit OS. I said, okay. And have we checked for any kind of update? When's the last time you've checked? And he said, well, we checked recently. His recently was a year ago, and it still wasn't available. And then he said, even if it was available, they can't go to 64-bit right now because of just cost, right? You'd have to wipe and reload. Just the labor to redo 20-something computers they don't want to pay. So I said, okay. So I said, I can look. I said, you called and she called. You've been updating your software every year since you've had these computers. Well, he said, wait, what software? I said, well, she just told me that you upgraded Sage a few days ago, and now the computers are slow. Oh, yeah, right. And then talking to him, he found out he updated this software and this software and this software over the years, right? I said, so over the years, as you're upgrading software, you're not upgrading hardware. The new software requires more resources. You're going to bog down your computer. So in the end, he said, okay, look, for me and for her, I offered to test the hardware, make sure the hardware's fine, make sure that there's not a bunch of stuff starting up that doesn't need to be starting up, you know, to kind of optimize it a little bit, make sure there's no malware, spyware, viruses. And if everything checks out, then he said, we'll just deal with being slow. So I had one of my techs do all that. Everything checked out fine. I had to tell him, it's fine. It's just close as many programs as you can. Don't leave everything open and just be slow. I mean, I can't fix it.
No.
It's Windows 7 32-bit. Now, the girl, he took the answer. He's like, I understand that. I know there's a problem with Windows 7 32-bit, but we can't do anything about it. The girl kept complaining, and I kept telling her, there's nothing we can do. And I had to actually call the owner back and say, look, she's not happy with our answers. I said, I asked him, what's your position? Do you agree or disagree with what we found? We can't find anything wrong with the hardware. We can't find any, there's no viruses, there's no spyware. We don't see anything running. He says, I'll talk to her. You know, so he talked to her, she stopped calling. And unfortunately, they're stuck on Windows 7 32-bit. And the answer is to get off of that program.
Right.
Or at the, what I would have recommended years ago, is don't get a Windows 7 32-bit computer. Get a 64-bit computer, and maybe it was really before virtual machines were popular, and run a 32-bit OS and virtualization just for that one app, if that's possible.
Well, hindsight's always 20/20, right? Because I know that probably, when was that? 7-8 years ago when we started rolling this out? No, 10 years. Because we probably did a few of those as well, where we just purchased 32-bit instead of 64. Mainly, it was because we weren't paying attention to the SKU when we ordered.
Yeah, they had these computers before we started doing work for them. But now that they're pretty old, they could get new computers with a virtual machine
running
32-bit. But the oil field's slow right now. Hopefully, that'll change soon. And so a lot of people down here based on the oil industry are having some real problems with the price of oil right now. A lot of companies going out of business, a lot of layoffs, so that's bad.
Well, shouldn't the price of oil go up in 3 days?
I'm hoping. And not to be too much, but not so much the price of oil, that no one can drill. So once all the drilling can start again, I think we'll be fine, at least down here, for jobs.
Well, not to go down a rabbit hole, but why can't they drill?
There's all kind of restrictions on where you can drill.
PETA and all that stuff. Save the whales. Tuna.
Well, more, it's just...
Not in our backyard.
it's bad.
All right, so let's transition. We have an email that is more a story. And the reason I know that is because the subject says exchange story in the email. So this is from John Campbell. And the first paragraph is really all about Star Wars versus Star Trek, so we're going to skip that. But he says, I work for a council that is joining with another council. Last week, a guy from the other council remarked that he could not connect to their exchange server on-premise. I asked if he wanted me to look into it, but as the IT guy from the other council was looking, they didn't want me to jump in and take over. I sat on my hands for an hour or two, waiting for them to determine why the exchange database was dismounted. After 2 hours, the bosses told me to take over. Within 10 minutes, I was able to determine that the database dismounted abruptly and was not in a clean state. So before we go on, Matt, I'm sure that a lot of guys who haven't worked with on-premise exchange, that is never really a good thing. That if you stop an exchange server or it crashes or shuts off, that database, if it shuts down improperly, it is a very potentially bad thing.
Yes, those damn dirty databases.
Dirty database. So he goes on. A little more digging shows that the team leader from the other council had decided to manually migrate some user accounts from one database to another. He was not aware that the logs are created for each of those moves. He managed to fill the drive that held the logs, and when this was full, the database dismounted. After spending the next 6 hours working on the issue, my team leader took over and nursed the database back to health. The database was remounted at approximately 3:30 a.m. the next morning. You're probably thinking, why didn't we just restore a backup? Well, about a month earlier, there were issues with the backups, so they stopped backing up the exchange server. They were confident that the server would be fine, and worst case, the emails were archived. And archiving was a council requirement. They had been talking to the backup support people. They have also spoken to Microsoft, and at no time did Microsoft suggest using the built-in backup within Windows 2012. If the server went down, the team leader felt that they would just get the users. And he puts in parentheses, 400 staff. So the team leader felt that they would just get the users to manually restore their own emails from the archives. Yes, let's get 400 staff to restore hundreds or thousands of emails all at once. Long story short, we now use Commvault Simpana to back up the Exchange server in the mailboxes every night. So I'll stop the email there. There's a couple of other things in there. But bottom line is, there's a whole lot of Exchange talk there.
Yeah, and that sounds like some real bad decisions being made by the management. No backups. And you can't get staff to do anything correctly.
Well, and 400 at once? I mean, that just sounds like a nightmare in and of itself, let alone how long of a process would that really take?
Well, they wouldn't do it. You would get 400 people calling you saying they screwed it up. And now you have to go to each computer to restore their archive, which is, I'm sure, local, right?
He didn't describe the environment, but I would hope so.
Well, if there are, yeah. I mean, that would be a complete mess. There's just some different things. If you're going to be supporting a company with an Exchange server on premises, there's just some things you have to know. And you don't need it often. I mean, I haven't had to use ESC util or IIS integ, you know, the integrity check much. I haven't had to use them much, but I've had to use them because those databases can get screwed up.
Oh, yeah.
So you really need to be aware. I'm not saying you need to memorize them. You need to know they're there, right? You need to know those commands exist, ESC util. So if you're supporting Exchange server, you need to know about ESC util. So look it up, read about it, because you'll need to know when you have an Exchange issue. Oh, wait, this database is doing this. This utility can fix that. And yes, it will take a while to run and all that stuff. It's not going to be a quick fix. I had some problems. Another thing, the two common things I see when you're hosting an Exchange on premises, one, you have to know DNS, but you have to know how to troubleshoot why mail's not coming in and why mail's not going out. Basic, right? That's what Exchange server is for. Send and receive mail. I had a call yesterday, which is funny. I call an email. They sent me an email to look and see why emails are bouncing back. And so I called her and I said, look, I got your email. But just so you know, whenever you have email issues, you shouldn't email that you have email issues because I might not get it. Oh, I didn't even think about that. I said, okay, I got it. But just for next time, you know, just call. And it just said that, well, actually it expired. The only bounce back message had expired in transit. And it was two different addresses.
Oh, I love that one.
Yeah. So one was a Cox.net address and one was some company. I forget the name. It was a company domain name. So I think I talked about before, SMTP Diag.
Oh, yeah. I love that tool. I use that.
Yes.
I love it.
So I use that and I always use it in verbose mode,
yep.
You know, the slash
that,
V.
Yep.
And we'll put a link in the show notes. But it came back and all it came back with was for both domains, unable to submit mail. That's it.
Even in verbose mode?
Yep.
Didn't do the checking at all of the...
It checked and it just came back. Because if you're familiar with SMTP DAG or you're not, you want to see green, right? And when you see red, that's an error. And all it had in the red part was fail to submit mail. So not much to work with, right? But very important thing when you have an Exchange server on premises is reverse DNS entry. I've seen many, many places now not accepting mail if there is no reverse DNS entry. So I'm on their server, right, running SMTP Diag. I go to ipchicken.com. You have used ipchicken.com?
I use intodns.net, but go ahead.
Okay. So ipchicken.com, it's got a cute little chicken. It's nice. You should check it out. It'll tell you right there if you have a reverse DNS entry. And they did. Their reverse entry was just their IP address. So I told them, and this is my gut, again, because the SMTP Diag didn't tell me much. It just said, cannot submit mail. I said, I'm betting that it's because you don't have a reverse DNS entry. I said, have the ISP create it. Let me know when it's done. The next day it was done. I checked, ran SMTP Diag again. It all went through. I told the customer, emailed them back again. It should go through, and it did. So important reverse DNS entries. You have to know that when you have an Exchange server, you need to have reverse DNS entry. You have to.
Yep.
And you should have SPF records, too, for any domain. But we won't talk about SPF records tonight.
Well, and just so that everybody understands, the SMTP Dyad tool is a very small utility, and you don't have to have an Exchange server to run it. So I just want to draw that out, that I just basically have that on my USB stick, and if I'm someplace, you know, I can run it from a desktop. It doesn't have to run on a server, but you just run the SMTP Dyad command with the email address from, email address to, and as Matt said, that /V gives you all the information you need to know. So
now be sure you run this. See, what we do by standard practice is block port 25 on all computers. The only port 25 that's open is from the Exchange server. So I have to run it from the server. So if I ran it from a workstation, it'd be blocked because of the router's blocking it, because it's going to go out on port 25. So if I didn't have port 25 blocked, I could run it from any computer. But if that's just our network, we're blocking port 25. So just make sure port 25 is open and you can run that utility. Right. Very nice utility, easy to use. And a lot of times it'll give you more explanation than fail to submit.
Right.
But since it was so vague, you know, I also checked for blacklist on MX Toolbox. That's the first thing I did when I found out she was getting bounce backs. It's always the first thing I do. But even if you're not on any blacklist on MX Toolbox, places like Cox and maybe other ISPs, don't list. They're not going to list in that MX Toolbox blacklist. They maintain their own blacklist. If you run the SMTP Dyad, it might tell you the blacklist that's blocking it. And a lot of times it is like att.net or something, because it'll show you what blacklist is blocking it, where MX Toolbox checks for certain ones, and that may not be the one that's blocking
right.
it. So,
and AT&T is one of those, that's always a joy, because they've got their own RBL inquiry site that you got to go to if you're on an AT&T list. So.
Right. And I think their standard practice is to ignore the first two removal requests and process the third one. Because every time I fill the paper out the same exact way, it takes three times for them to do it. Mm. And I know what you're going to say. Oh, well, it says you got to wait 24 to 48 hours. I wait the 48 hours and it's still not working. I do it again, wait 48 hours again, still not working, right? So now from the first one to the second one, now it's 96 hours. I do it a third time, and the next day it's working.
So it's either three times a lady or 100 hours.
Or they really want to make sure that you really need to be removed.
Right. Yeah, it's just some kid playing around. He doesn't need to be removed.
And we're just going to keep blocking him. He doesn't really mean it. Now, another thing that I see as common with people hosting Exchange servers is not doing the SSL cert, right, for their Exchange server.
Right.
That's important. It's important mainly for you, the company, not for people outside the company. It's more for the company to be able to have the SSL cert. Now, in the past, some phones needed SSL cert to connect. Outlook Anywhere needed it to connect, right? If you didn't have a cert on Outlook Anywhere, you couldn't connect. So SSL certs are often ignored on Exchange servers. That's important. Now, SBS server made it easy.
Right, because they would create their own self-signed cert.
Well, it's easy to get a third party. We always did third party, because you really want a third party if you get into an SSL cert.
But I know a lot of techs would just use the built-in SBS stuff.
That's garbage. You might as well not even use it. Because you're still going to get, then you have to import it, right?
Yep.
Yeah, so then what you could do is just have the 400 employees import their own private SSL cert, self-signed. Yeah, that's a good idea. No. The same reason we don't want users importing their archive is the same reason I don't want to create instructions and have them import the self-signed SSL cert. Get a public one and they're done. A little bit harder with Exchange, new Exchange, because you got to run some command prompts and stuff like that. Make sure it's attached correctly, but you still need an SSL cert. Now, are you still putting Exchange servers in-house? If you have a new client right now that needs Exchange, what would you do?
To be honest, the last Exchange server that I installed was 4 years ago. So I don't know what I would do. Most of my small customers has been Office 365. And I do have one very large customer, and you're going to laugh. They have 180 users, 8 locations, 1 Exchange server.
Wow. Well, I've got that beat.
All right.
I've got one Exchange server with 250 users on it.
All right. Is it integrating with another third-party vendor program?
I got single sign-on for SharePoint, ShareFile, and some other stuff.
That's nice. So this company, they have to have an on-prem Exchange server to work with their case management system.
Yeah, okay, I remember you talking about that.
Yeah, they can't do it any other way. But they are coming up on the point where they have to upgrade their software at some point. But they
so why do they have to have an Exchange server on-prem? They can't use a connector, or is it?
Yeah, the software that they're using at the time that it was done, and this was that's sad. 2005 is when we installed this software, and they've only upgraded one point of a version. They went from version 8.5 to version 8.6, and they've done no other upgrades since then. So that particular version can only work with an on-prem Exchange server that is on the same site as the SQL server. So we've got the database, SQL running, and the Exchange server, and basically everything is interconnected that way. There are newer versions of the software that once they upgrade, we can go to hosted Exchange, Office 365, do whatever. But this customer has been unwilling to upgrade. They're so afraid of the back office because this package basically was custom made for them. And what used to happen is every time they did an upgrade, they would lose half of their back office operations. So they don't want to do that. They want the company to guarantee them that they won't lose any of their customizations, their reports. And of course, the company's like, sorry, that ain't going to happen.
Right.
So, but they've got to make a decision because this is the customer that's also, they can't go past Windows 7 or Office 2010 because their stuff won't work. So they've got some very monumental money decisions to make here. And I told them that they really need to make this decision in 2017 because I don't know if I can guarantee anything beyond that in terms of getting Office 2010 anymore, getting Windows 7 machines, even if we just buy licenses and, you know, build them from scratch because they're so used to now buying HP machines. And we know that HP's not going to continue to sell downgraded licenses much longer.
No, not for much longer. Yeah, I had a client similar who didn't update their software for 10, 15 years. And when they got to a point, it was going to cost them, I think I mentioned this before, it was going to cost them like $250,000 to upgrade. And if they would have done it every year or every point upgrade, you know, like 9, 10, 11, it would only cost them a couple thousand a year. But since they didn't, there's only a couple of people who know that old software, and they said it's very tedious. And I think their bill was going to be like $250,000 because they waited so long.
I could see that happening to this customer. And the bulk of their cost isn't going to be the software. It's going to be the conversion.
Right, yep.
So that's going to get them. And then we start to upgrade computers.
And he had told them, they had asked them how long the conversion would take. And let's say they were on like 3, and the new version was like 12. He said, well, I have to take the data, and I have to go from 3 to 4.
To 5.
4 yep. to 5. And he said, when I do that, I'm taking the data from, let's say, day 1. You can't enter any more data in it, because now I'm converting the data. So whatever data you have, pencil and paper, until I can be done with it. And I said, well, how long will it take? He said, 6 weeks. Is my best estimate. So for 6 weeks, they're not going to, if they did this, they wouldn't be with their program because they chose not to upgrade for years and years and years and years. Now, in the end, I think they just went to a different product and are going to be just accessing that for historical purposes. But so that they found something else from what I understand. But this company, we stopped doing work for them. They got bought out. I'm so glad because I didn't have to be involved with that because I knew it was coming. And in fact, one of the office managers quit her job knowing that this was coming, and she didn't want to be involved in it. So she quit. She said, I don't need the headache. So that's how bad this product was going to be because they put it off for so long.
Yeah, I can imagine. I don't know what I'm going to do when this time comes. Now, granted, the vendor's going to do a big portion of it, but a lot of it's going to be based on us. And we're talking about, too, we've got the SQL server that's old. We're talking SQL 2005. We're talking Exchange 2010. Both of those are going to have to be upgraded. And there are five offices that are replicating data through DFS, and those servers are now going into their fifth year.
Wow,
so
that's going to be a lot of work.
I've got seven servers that we're going to have to plan out this migration across five offices, 180 people, and the software takes about an hour to install per workstation, and it's a manual process. There is no way to automate it.
Sounds like you need your tech help on you on this one.
Yeah. So I am so looking forward to that, but that is going to be, I've actually already mapped out part of the project, and I've already told them that they're basically going to prepay for a big chunk of the product up front. Just because, I mean, we are talking, they want to have this done in one weekend.
Oh, gee whiz.
So, I mean, I've already imagined that I've got to have, you know, eight technicians across these five offices.
They at least got to close, like, on Friday, so you can get in at least early Friday, have a three-day weekend.
No, they want to stop at 5 o'clock, and we're going to work in shifts till the problem is I have no idea how long it's going to take the company to convert the data, and I have no idea how long it's going to take us to migrate the Exchange server if we have to do another on-prem Exchange server. Because if at least if they go to Office 365 or hosted Exchange, I can use the migration tools and pre-populate those. That I can handle.
Right. And they would have to go to, oh, I would definitely recommend hosted Exchange. We haven't been putting in Exchange servers anymore. We put some in recently, but we're not going to do it anymore.
And so what's your reasoning for no more? No mas?
Well, I like the Office 365, that it's in the cloud. And that's what makes sense to be in the cloud, is email in the cloud. If their internet's down at their office, they can still send and receive mail. It's not tied to their internet connection. There's way less maintenance on an Exchange server, because there's no Exchange server. It's an easy sell. Most clients, when we show them a price of an Exchange server with the licensing based on versus hosted Exchange with the benefits that comes with it, they've all chosen the hosted Exchange.
I agree with that, and I will probably push as many people. Like I said, I've been pushing everybody to Office 365. I do have two customers that are on full hosted Exchange, but the Office 365 with... we've even purchased the Backupify to back up Office 365 just for whatever reason, for archiving purposes. Yeah, I love it because, again, no maintenance from my standpoint. Right now, those on-premise exchanges, even though I've got good backups, I just don't want to have to deal with them if there's a crash.
Yeah, and there's less backup space, so whatever backup you're doing, if you don't have to back up the Exchange server, you're freeing up a lot of backup space. If it's cloud backup or if it's even anything else, if you're not backing up 200 gigabytes of mail, that's a lot less you're backing up. Now, we have some on Office 365. That's mostly what we put on now. We still have some on SureWeb. We still have quite a few on Intermedia. But I think the new ones we've been putting on 365 more than anything else.
Direct Microsoft with the CSP program? Or?
Yeah, we have a partner account, so we get it through our partner account. Then we get licenses through Synnex, I think.
Synnex Tech Data has them as well. I've not done the program. I'm using AppRiver because I want them to have somebody to call if I'm not available, and I'm trying not to be available from 5 p.m. to 9 a.m.
If you have any problems, feel free to try and find my number. but we haven't had any problems with them, Office 365, so...
I mean, think about it, though. I mean, I've got a customer that we're going to be pushing to Office 365. They've got an on-prem. They've got a SBS 2011 still. And their biggest problem is their office has power outages like once or twice a month, always on a weekend. And they're a service industry where, you know, they've got to be able to respond to service emails. And they've gotten to the point where we've purchased the biggest battery backup we can get for them. But it still only keeps them up for about 90 minutes. So if they lose power and the server goes down, they can't do their emails. They have somebody on call to run to the office to plug in a generator so they didn't get the server back up while the building's... It's a ridiculous type of thing.
It sounds like they need an automatic standby generator.
Well, they can't. They're in an office complex where they're not allowed to put that in. But, of course, they're asking me, what can we do? I'm like, go to the cloud, Office 365. Yeah, but it's so much per person per month. I said, okay, when you're down, how much is that costing you? You're spending a lot more by being down than you would by paying for Office 365.
Yeah.
And that's, I think I've got them to finally understand, you know, I mean, because it's ridiculous. And they have, their server is, it's really weird. They've got, it's a field management software that I cannot for the life of me find a way. There's two services that even if I set them to automatically restart, and I've put them in my Logic Now dashboard with a scheduled task upon startup to make sure those services are running, I can't guarantee that they'll start running. So anytime there's a power outage, I literally have to, when that server comes up, I have to check to see if those services are running. And if, really? And if they're not, their field management software doesn't work. So I've convinced them. I said, you need to go to the cloud version of this software and go to Office 365. So they're looking at doing that. But it's those types of things that, you know, it was great in the day because, you know, we could charge whatever and, you know, come to the rescue and fix all that stuff. But the money's not worth it.
No. I don't like those email problems because those Exchange servers we've had, when they crash, they can crash pretty bad and it can take a while. I don't want to be up till 3:30 in the morning rebuilding databases.
You mentioned the ESE Util program. The company that I just mentioned, I literally would schedule twice a year to do full maintenance on their mail server. And it started out back, you know, 2005, 2008. I could start the maintenance Friday night, and then it would be done by Saturday morning, 10, 11 o'clock. It's at the point now, the last time I did it was 4 years ago, because I said I'm not doing this anymore. I almost got them to purchase that Lucid product that had the continual maintenance. But the last time I did it, I started Friday at 6 p.m. That maintenance did not finish until Sunday. And they were complaining about being offline that long. I'm like, well, then you either get a second Exchange server so we can have one up and while the other's in maintenance, or you go to the cloud. Well, we can't go to the cloud because we got the software. Those are the joys of being an enterprise business.
Yeah, was that back in the day when you had the 75 gigabyte limit on the database?
Yes.
So you had to, if they were getting close, you had to have them archive out, yep, and then defrag the database to reclaim the space.
Yep.
We did that so often. We had so many clients on that. We had hundreds, you know, well over 100, 150 on the SBS03. And I can't tell you how many. It was almost a weekly occurrence for a while. Somebody was calling us saying email was down. You log in. Okay. You're at, I would always put the limit at 70, mm-hmm, to dismount, and that way I would get a little warning. Because,
right,
if it goes over 75 and you can't mount it, that's bad. Yes. So I would always put it at 70 and say, okay, I can turn it on, but you have to archive. And when you're done archiving, I have to run a defrag to reclaim the space. How long would it take? It's going to take hours, 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 hours. And if they didn't listen to me right away, if it would go like a few days, because every morning it checks the size, and the next morning it dismounts, right? If it was getting close to 75, I would just turn SMTP service off. That way they can't send or receive any more mail. That way their database won't grow until they would archive out. That way the database could still mount, but they wouldn't send or receive mail.
Right.
So it was always like pulling teeth, and I'd say, we have to do this. You have to archive. And they'd say, okay, we're done. And I would take a screenshot of mailbox size before, and then I go in and take a screenshot of mailbox sizes after. It was funny how nobody changed.
That's right. Yeah, I deleted some email.
I'd send it back to her saying, okay, this person looks like they deleted 18 emails. This person is bigger. So have them try again. So that was all. That was the fun days. Yeah.
Yeah. That was, remember when the limit was only 16 gig?
Yeah, that was a long time ago.
I mean, that was back when we were still using Outlook Express.
Was it 16 or was it 12? And then you had to go run that hack. You had to go change the registry to make it 75.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And so moving them from Outlook Express to Exchange was a huge deal. And Then we went to from 16 to 75. Oh, you'll never fill that up.
Yeah, that's like 32-bit OS. So you'll never need more than 4 gigs of RAM. Come on, what are you talking about here?
Memory lane with exchange servers.
But that's going to be a lost skill. Everyone's going to be on a hosted exchange, Office 365 in the years to come, and it's going to be for at least for us kind of tech, right? Large businesses are still going to want to have it in-house. The average person that I think we and our listeners are going to support aren't going to need Exchange Server in-house.
No.
Especially since Microsoft's making it harder to have it in-house.
Absolutely, yeah.
I think it's going to be a lost skill. It's going to be one of those things in 10 years where you're going to get a call from an Exchange Server and you're like, you still have Exchange Server? What's wrong with it? It just doesn't work, you know? And you're going to need to call back on these skills. If you're old enough to have had an Exchange Server in-house, you'll be able to know how to fix it.
And you can charge a premium for that.
Yep.
But here's the thing, though. I remember having an argument with a junior tech who did not understand. Because the one thing that, I mean, I'm sure it'll be fixed at some point and it'll be taken away, but there's still a physical limit to the local OST file. That if somebody hits that, you know, because the mailbox size limit is 50 gig, which is really like 49.6 or whatever it is, so that somebody on a local machine that their OST file gets that big, their mailbox may only say it's 20 gig. But if their OST file is at that 50 gig limit, all of a sudden they're having mailbox issues. I literally argued with a junior tech telling him that, well, we need to rebuild that, you know, file. And he couldn't understand the concept. All you got to do is blow away the OST file, let it rebuild. And I mean, now granted, I you know, this is one junior tech, and I'm sure that most of the people listening right now understand this. And if you don't, it is a simple concept. But it's almost like techs are just not learning stuff. They hear about the stuff, they set it up, and they don't take the time to learn the process. That if those types of issues happen, how do you, you know, he didn't even know where to look.
Well, same place you find a PST file. Go to data file management, open folder. There it is.
Yeah, but he was thinking that, well, it's in the cloud. There's nothing local. It's in the cloud. And I had to explain to him, no, there's still...
Well, I guess if we turned off cash exchange mode, it could be in the cloud.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, you could. But for them, they needed the cash exchange mode for their... Just, you know...
Most people want it because some things don't work if you're not in cash exchange mode. Now, one thing I also do, manage online backup. When I'm set up on a workstation, I always exclude OST files.
Absolutely.
It's not going to be there by default. You got to go to exclusions and
turn it off.
Turn it on, because I don't want those OST, because that's going to change constantly and it's always going to push the update, then the whole thing.
And there's really no reason to back up
an
OST file with hosted exchange or Office 365. They're going to rebuild.
Right.
And if you're worried about mail history or whatever, then you archive. You know,
you need the archiving add-on or you need something. But the OST files are, in my opinion, temp files, just indexes to make your mail searchable, and some things need to work in that mode. Right. So disable OST and do it before you start the initial backup. Because once you tell it to start, you make any changes, I want to exclude that, too late. It's going to run the initial backup. When you first turn on, if you use manage only backup in Logic Now, when you go, turn it on then, before you hit start the first backup.
Well, yeah, because it's going to be like, well, you already told me it was there, so I know it's there.
Right.
I know it's there. You can't
stop me. Yeah. I'm backing that thing up.
So, ladies and gentlemen, if you have, well, let's take a break from exchange stories. Wait a couple of weeks before you send us another exchange story. We're gonna hit another topic next week, and we still haven't. When Martin comes back, we got to do our country music hoedown that we promised from last week. And so, Matt, anything else? We've had a nice meaty show this week.
Yeah, it was good. I don't have anything else. If you want to send us an email, podnutspro@podnuts.com. We'd love to hear from you.
We would, and we'll put in our show notes all the stuff that we talked about with all the links, some of the exchange utilities, IP chicken, into DNS, SMTP diag. Folks, grab the SMTP diag, even if you're not hosting it on an on-premise exchange. It is a very, very valuable tool that literally takes a few seconds to run to help diagnose mail issues. So, all right, so Matt, do another goodbye while I figure out a quote for us this week from our good friend.
Another goodbye. Goodbyes are so hard. I'm sorry. I'll say goodbye from Martin. Martin wishes everybody good tidings, even though he couldn't be with us. And if you want to check out some network documentation, go to informedit.net. Document all of your customer settings. And people talk about the business computer toolkit.
Yes.
Is that what I'm saying? Right?
Yep.
It's not like that. That is more contracts and contracts and work orders. This is more documenting settings, your router settings, line of business application settings for your customer. Where is the data for it? How do you back that data up? How do you restore that data? All different kinds of forms. Check them out. Use promo code PODNUTS for a 25% discount.
And as Martin would say, yes.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mark and Marvin, a.k.a. Martin.
All right. So, ladies and gentlemen, we thank you for listening and subscribing to the podcast. And as per usual, our outgoing line from our favorite founding father, Mr. Benjamin Franklin, to succeed, jump as quickly at opportunities as you do at conclusions. Ladies and gentlemen, we hope that you have a very pleasant and profitable week, and we will see you, or you will hear us, next time on PodNuts Pro.
My name is Jeff Houch. I am the host of PodNuts, the Computer Repair Podcast, where we take live calls on the air to answer your questions on running and operating your computer repair business every Sunday at 4 p.m. Eastern. You can check it out over at podnuts.com/Computer Repair Podcast Live. Music provided by Steve Cherubino at stevecherubino.com.